There are those who work to make sense of what the sex lives of bugs, birds, and beasts tell us about evolution, biodiversity, and even ourselves. Yes, some penises sing and some have vibrators, I kid you not, and there are females that sort sperm and flush out the rejects. Now the story of evolution as you've never heard it before. Our guest is Menno Schildhausen. He's an evolutionary biologist. He's a research scientist at Naturalist Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands. He's a professor of character evolution and biodiversity at Leiden University, and he's the author of Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. And he joins us this morning from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Menno, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you.
So I'm just guessing, when you tell people that you study bug sex for a living, what kind of reactions are you getting, Menno?
Well, it's usually a mixture of awe, surprise, a bit of disgust. It's a
disgust,
complex mixture.
Even? Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Well, as soon as I start talking about it, yes.
Yeah. Well, why is it so important to study the evolution of animal sex organs? Why is that so important?
Well, it's really it's a mixture of two things. First of all, I guess we're all whether we like to admit it or not, very interested in sex, and not just human sex, but but the reproduction of anything that slithers and moves.
I think that's right.
So yeah, let's not kid ourselves. We really are into that. And on the scientific side of things, we make use of that fascination by studying sexual behavior and the shapes and functions of insects and other animal penises and vaginas, because that's really where evolution performs its greatest tricks.
I was going to say, that you learn a lot from doing that, and you learn a lot about evolution. Why?
Well, it's because evolution is all about leaving more descendants than the next guy in the same species. And of course, one obvious way to do that is to have reproductive organs that work better than the next guy or girls do. So it's obvious that anything, any improvement in those organs will have a major impact in a species. So we see that in those organs, in penises and vaginas and the whole reproductive plumbing that's involved, the biggest differences and evolve and the fastest.
And when it comes to evolution, if I understand correctly, you see the most dramatic changes in the genitalia of bugs and beasts. Do I have that right?
Yeah, but not only bugs and beasts. It's actually almost all animals, even if they're different species, but they look very similar on the outside, they're usually very different in the genitalia. And it's also a very useful way for naturalists to recognize species and to distinguish them, even if they're very similar in the other parts of their body.
When did you first become interested in the field of evolutionary biology and maybe more specifically in the study of animal genitalia?
Well, if I'm really honest, I have to say it was when I was 12.
What happened to you at 12?
Well, I had a great biology teacher who took us in the Netherlands near Rotterdam, where I lived, who took us out into the fields and the forest and the dunes every weekend, and with a little group of school children. And we all picked our own group of animals or plants to work on, and I picked insects. So I would pin these insects, and sometimes I would bring him a few pinned specimens and ask him whether he could help me identify them. And sometimes he would say, well, these things are really too similar to identify just by looking at them. You really have to extract the genitalia and prepare those, and then you can tell which species it is. So that's the first time I really became aware of the fact that there's something special going on with these genitalia.
And a 12-year-old boy, you might be interested in genitalia.
I was becoming interested in them, yes.
And what can we learn about, maybe this is a key question, about human sexuality from the study of animal, bird, and insect genitalia?
Yeah. Well, human sexual organs also differ very much from the sexual organs of our close relatives. If you look at the way the female and male genitals look and function in chimpanzees and bonobos and gorillas, they're even more different, and humans, they're even more different from each other than the rest of the body is. I mean, we like to focus, of course, on our big brains and our opposable toes and things like that, or non-opposable toes in our case. But really, the biggest differences, at least as big as the differences in brain size, are in the way these genitals function. For example, chimpanzees have spines along their penis. They have vaginas which change in depth during their reproductive cycle, which are all things that that humans don't have.
Why would there be a spine on a penis? What's the point of that?
Right.
And just for the record, I've never asked that question before in my life. That's a first here in 446,000 questions here over 12 years. That's the first time I've asked that question.
I suppose it is. And yet it's a question that's being asked a lot in evolutionary biology at the moment.
Okay. So
for the moment, you'll be an honorary evolutionary biologist.
That's the least you could do for putting me through this, Menno. That's the least you could do. Yeah.
Well, we find spiny penises cropping up literally almost very frequently in the animal kingdom. A lot of insects have them, a lot of reptiles have them, and many mammals, including primates, have them.
And, but in theory, that doesn't sound like a real good idea.
It doesn't sound like a very pleasant idea. It may not even be a very pleasant idea for the females. The only thing we know for sure is how these things function in insects, and there it turns out that they literally produce wounds in the skin of the female's vagina, which in itself may not be a good thing, but it is a good thing if it, at least for the male's point of view, if it helps proteins from his semen to make their way into the female's bloodstream. And these proteins, they sort of mess with the female's psychology, in insects at least, because they turn off her sex drive. They make her completely uninterested in sex for a few days after they've mated with this particular male. And of course, from the male's point of view, that's good, because that means that his sperm will not have to compete with other male sperm, at least for a few days.
But if the whole point of evolution is to propagate a species, then why is it that a penis that's that difficult for a female to receive, that wouldn't help with that whole propagation thing?
Well, it wouldn't help for propagating the species necessarily, but that's frankly not really what evolution is about. Evolution is about being sort of promoting the reproductive success of an individual. If there is an individual in a let's say you have a species that's completely smooth penised, which doesn't have any spines, and then suddenly there is this one male mutant who crops up who does have spines on his penis, and he's able to make those proteins leach into the female's bloodstream and do their thing, then this genetic trait will spread in the population and will turn the whole species into a species that has a spiny penis, even though they didn't have that before. Even if it's a little bit less beneficial for the females, if it's still something that's beneficial for the males, then it will spread in the population. Although, of course, the countermeasure could be for the females to evolve more thick-skinned vaginas, for example.
Okay. Menno Skilthausen is our guest. His new book, Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. If you're listening to this segment and you want to help out the host by calling in and taking some of the load off, this would be a great time to call and bail me out here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, that's 816-235-2888. We were talking, Menno, about chimpanzees and their similarity or dissimilarity to human beings. The things you learn doing this show: male chimpanzees insert solid sperm plugs into females' vaginas to prevent them from successfully mating with other males during one fertile period. Can you share some other examples of how males work to ensure that they are, in fact, the fathers?
There's the example you just mentioned of sperm plugs.
I've never heard of that before.
No, it's not not generally known. It's a rather distasteful subject, I must admit. But it's very important evolutionarily, because it occurs in a lot of groups of animals, reptiles also, and in spiders. there's something even more extreme going on. There, in some cases, the whole spiders have they have two little boxing gloves next to the sides of their heads, which basically are their penises. So they have two of them, and they usually use them only once, because in many spiders the male gets eaten after or even during copulation with the female. So they have very little to lose, and when they mate, and what they do is often they leave behind their entire pedipalp, as this organ is called. So it's essentially they're leaving behind their entire penis, which is literally screwed into the female's vagina and doesn't become detached very easily, and that makes it very hard for the next male to also mate with this female until this pedipalp drops off. And there's even a spider which uses its entire body as a so-called mating plug. So it locks on to the female, it inseminates her, and then it just euthanizes itself. It simply dies, and it keeps hanging from the female's vagina for a day after having mated with her. So the female walks around with this dead male, and all the while she's inaccessible to other males.
You know, the things you learn, you know, again, there's a public relations sheet that came with your book with a whole page of facts from this book, Nature's Nether Regions. Here's one. The fallopian tubes of female hamsters are folded into 15 zigzag loops. Just who would have thunk it? Female spotted hyenas have 7-inch long clitorises through which they give birth. And no one's calling here, Menno. Absolutely no one has called to bail me out. Everyone's scared to ask the questions that I've got to do. I have to carry the heavy load here today. You also write in a section titled, well, I'm going to go on here. Why do you think humans lost the spines that you were talking about before? I mean, thank goodness, but why don't humans have the spines you were talking about?
Yeah, that's actually a question I can't really answer. We know very little about the way our own genitals have evolved, surprisingly little, really. If you compare it with what we've learned over the last few decades from fruit flies, from seed beetles, from spiders, from hamsters even, like you mentioned, about how these organs evolve, it's surprising that we have spent so little time on trying to understand how our own genitals, and since we're so interested in them, obviously, we know scientifically very little about how they evolved and why they look and function the way they do. I mean, we take it for granted. But of course,
what's your theory why that is, why we haven't studied our own private parts more than we have?
Yeah, well, there's probably two reasons. I think one of them, of course, is that humans and large mammals are much more difficult to study than a small insect you can keep in a little tube, and you can do all kinds of awful things with without any ethical committees breathing down your neck. But I think there's also, so there's these practical limitations, but I think there's also a bit of shame and embarrassment and cultural obstacles even among serious scientists. I mean, there are some experiments that have been going on in the 1970s and 1990s, which are basically the only experiments there are on how the human genitals function. And of course, these involve getting volunteers and rigging them with wires in their genitals. And this is not something that you would easily either get permission for or ask your colleagues or your students to participate in.
It's one thing to do them to bugs, something else to do it to a live human being.
Exactly.
Yeah. You say in this book that human penis size is not correlated to shoe size. Who collected the data on that one?
Well, I forgot the name, but it was a citizen science project, actually, a website. I think it was called the Ultimate Penis Survey. It still exists. You can still participate in it if you like, which collected measurements from men all over the world, just by sort of self-submitting the information on various things, including penis length and shoe size. But also other biometrics, I think nose length was also in there, and weight. And so the person who set up this citizen science project looked at correlations, and he found that contrary to the popular myth, there is zero correlation between shoe size and flaccid penis size, I think.
It, well, the natural follow-up question here, does size matter?
Well, that's, of course, shape matters much more than size. I think that's one general conclusion we can draw from this general field of science and from my book. But in some cases, size does matter, although usually it matters in a different way than we tend to think. In most animal species, you find that penis size is actually very stable. It's quite unrelated to the size of the entire body. There's there are some insects, for example, which differ enormously in body size as a male, but when you then measure the size of their penis, it's all the same, almost the same in all these differently sized individuals. And that probably has to do with something that that is known as the one-size-fits-all theory, which says that, of course, if you have an intermediate-sized penis and an intermediate-sized vagina, the number of possible mates is maximized. Of course, if you're on, on one of either the minimum or the maximum extreme, you'll find very few individuals that have the apparatus that allows them to mate with you.
Well, there are some pretty odd examples in this book. One is an Argentine lake duck that has a 17-inch long penis, a worm whose genitalia is on its head. You know, it doesn't sound like the study of animal genitalia ever gets boring. I'm wondering, what are some of the most exciting discoveries that you've uncovered over the years?
Well, one thing that I personally do research on is asymmetric genitalia, which is something that I'm quite excited about because it's so so counterintuitive. We've learned over the past few decades that symmetry is sexy. That if you present a volunteer, for example, with a lot of different faces of members of the opposite sex, and some of them are a bit more symmetric than others, they always tend to prefer the most symmetric faces. And yet when we look at the evolution of genitalia in animals, you see that time and time again, these strongly asymmetric genitalia appear, where, for example, a pig has a corkscrew-shaped penis, which is, of course, asymmetric because every spiral is asymmetric.
Yeah.
Camels have two-pronged penises with one prong much longer than the other. So that's actually very surprising that in something that should be symmetric, because symmetry is sexy, you see these asymmetric shapes appearing. And we haven't really got the answer yet about why that is, but I think that's something that might become an important field over the next few years.
Menno Skilthausen is our guest. He's a research scientist at Naturalist Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands. He's the author of a new book, Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Dudy from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Actually, it's pronounced Dodie.
Dodie. I'm sorry. Dodie, go ahead.
That's okay. I have a comment. I think it's hilarious that you have no callers this morning.
Thanks for breaking the ice, Dodie. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to say the word penis on the air. Just get it over with. I think it's hilarious that the most important thing this story has to tell us is about ourselves, about our humility, about our unwillingness to approach the very important topic of our own sexuality, the most baseful, primal, driving force of our humanity. And I think it's very, very interesting. And even I am embarrassed, and I'm liberal, and I will say the P word on the air. So I think it's very, very interesting. I applaud you for having this topic in first a scientific context that makes it more approachable. I love the idea of the book. I can't wait to read it myself. And so that's my observation. I'll take anything else you want to say off the air.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Dodie. And Menno, what do you think about what she said?
Well, I think Doty is absolutely right that it is something we are so fascinated by, and yet we're not doing nearly enough research into it. Of course, the medical profession could help us out here. There's a lot of gynecologists and urologists who have information, who have the ability to help evolutionary biologists study the evolution of our own genitalia. So I really think biologists should join forces with physicians and medical specialists in research hospitals to maybe get this research field off the ground again, because I agree with Doty that it's really important and it's really fascinating, and we after so many centuries of researching our own bodies, we still know so little about how these genitals function.
You know, what else is missing when it comes to research in the field of human sexuality that we need to be looking at that we're not looking at?
Well, if you'd like to break another taboo on air, the function of the female orgasm, that's mm-hmm. Something that is discussed profusely and at length in all the glossies, and yet we have almost no data about why it exists, what it might be good for. And there are some information, some experiments actually from the 1970s that suggest that by having an orgasm, a human female can actually select sperm of certain males in preference over other male sperm, because the orgasm creates basically a vacuum in the uterus which might suck in some of the semen. And it's strange that even as recently as 2005, a popular book has appeared which suggested that the female orgasm has no function at all. It's just a byproduct of the fact that there is a male orgasm.
Mm-hmm. Well, some breaking news in your field. I just came across an article last night. Scientists have discovered the first case of genital reversal, a female penis, a male vagina. This discovery was made in a cave in Brazil in some little-known insects. Can you talk to us about the discovery and maybe explain what makes a female female and what makes a male male?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I was also very excited about this discovery. There are a few other animals which have that, where the female has an organ that looks like a penis, which she uses to penetrate the male and basically reach for his sperm and obtain it. And this happens in this cave insect because there the males produce a so-called spermatophore, which is not just sperm, but it also includes a lot of nutrients for the female. So it's and especially in the cave where there's very little food, these spermatophores are very important for the female to obtain to produce nutrients for her young, for her to produce her offspring. So here the males are actually the desired commodity, and females compete with each other over access to these males. So the situation is reversed compared to what we see in most species, and that's why also these genitalia are reversed.
Well, Menno Skildhausen's new book is titled Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. What an interesting conversation, Menno. Thank you for taking the time with us today. I sure appreciate it.
Me too, Steve. Thank you very much.
All the best. You bet.